Gentlemen, good evening. Bonsoir à tous. Bienvenue à cette deuxième série des soirées publiques du Centre de recherche sur le cancer Goodman. It's the second year we're doing this. We had a series with four lectures last year, which we describe different steps of cancer, you know, from their initiation, the progression of the disease, metastasis, treatment. This year we'll do a bit different. We still have, I don't think we'll go every, especially tonight, we're not going to go in every single step, but we have special thematics which I think are very important, and we hear in the newspaper, and perhaps that's where we can help you a bit more, having an idea about is this important or not. And I'll start by telling you, so tonight, it will be agents and disease that trigger cancer, particularly we're looking at, you'll see infectious disease and cancer. And this is always the, you know, the scary part, can we catch cancer? And it is for people which are involved in cancer research, sometimes a bit funny to hear that. And we'll see at the end, we'll summarize the take-home message. Cancer cannot be caught by hugging somebody that needs support at the hospital. But they are infectious disease, which, in fact, bring you a higher risk of cancer. So we'll talk about that a bit later. And I'll come back at the end to make this little take-home message. Then we'll have our panel in front so you can ask all the questions you want, and we'll do that. La prochaine session, c'est le 25 novembre. Et you probably have heard a lot about personalized medicine. It's a big, trendy word. Comme Québécois ou Canadien, nos deux gouvernements, the Canadian and the Quebec government, are now looking at spending a lot of money in personalized medicine. What does that mean for cancer patient, cancer research? What does it mean for all the tax we're paying? And I think it is something we'd like to talk to you about. We'll have a series of specialists which are doing personalized medicine, and they could answer you and see how this will affect the treatment of our peers, our colleagues, our family, and ourselves. Ça va être le 25 novembre. And on the session number 3, on the 24th of March next year, we'll talk about stem cells. That, again, it's a topic which is quite debated. Stem cells, gene cloning, but this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about stem cells in cancer. Why, for example, some breast cancer patients are cured over 5 years, 10 years after the curing their disease, they have cancers, often very similar cancer coming back. Is it the stem cell, cancer stem cells we have not eliminated? Is it also potentially the target that we should to aim on? And everything else that we're doing is useless unless we kill those stem cells. So friends or foes, because there's also many good application of stem cells, but we'll see how. So we'll have many people talking about this. And we have a last event, which is not I forgot to put on there, where we're going to talk about patient and survivorship, what's happening after you have cancer. It's a bit more, less scientific and more, I would say, friendly and human experience of cancers and as a patient and as a family of cancer. So this will be announced a bit later on. So tonight we have four speakers. I'm starting now, and I'll tell you a few little stories to prepare the other speakers. Phil Branton will be the second speaker. Phil not only was my mentor when I was at McMaster University, mais Phil Branton était aussi le directeur de l'Institut du cancer du Canada pendant plusieurs années. C'est lui qui a été le premier directeur des instituts IRSC, des CIHR Institute. He was the first director when this was established in the early 2000. So he's been at the core of all the discussion about cancer, prevention, infectious disease. He's a virologist by training, so he's the perfect person to talk to you about infectious agent and cancer. Le deuxième conférencier, Venkata Ramana Kumar Aginotram. I'm trying my best. This is a challenge on its own. But Venkata is an epidemiologist. He will tell us a bit about particularly one infectious disease, which is very important. And it's also related to HPV, So cervic cancers, but many other cancers will see that. Venkata also will tell you about the vaccine. And my three daughters were some of the first ones vaccinated in the West Island when the time that you had to pay for it, right? So, but now it's offered by everybody, and there's few issues. I'm not sure you'll raise the issue of why not vaccinating boys, for example. You will talk about that. That's great. So thank you very much. And we have also our clinician, T. Wong. She's an oncologist at Jewish Hospital in MUHC. T, I know that she has clinic also tonight, so she's not here yet. Hopefully she'll catch up and join us. She's a specialist also of rectal cancer, anal cancer, HPV, and many of these infectious diseases. She has been at the core of this on the epidemiology studies in Montreal for this disease, so I think she could bring, and she will bring, hopefully, if she show up. And we're waiting for, see if she has seen all her patients, she should be here on time. So, and we'll have a small question period after that. So that sounds okay. We'll have a microphone. We'll pass around, and j'espère que les trois autres conférenciers, Philippe, Venkata et T, tous les trois parlent français très très bien et d'autres langues. Et donc, you can ask your question in French ou en anglais. In English or in French? En français? You didn't understand that one. Okay. So let me start by a scary movie. So I don't want to scare you now. Hopefully it will work, by the way. It's something I'd like to show you. And it's really touching the topic of tonight. So. So I will just a bit summarize for you if you have not heard all of the few points. One of the things, this is called cancer clusters. So this happened in Australia, and the Australian Broadcasting Company, as it was written, as said about 4 or 5 years ago, they talk about 16 women, but in fact, over a period of 10 to 12 years in that building, there was another 12, I think it was over 25 women which were diagnosed with breast cancer, and as it says in the little trailer, at one particular desk, the six women sitting there had... yes, you can open the light. Yeah. Thank you very much. And many of them... That's light for you. So this caused a real upward in at the ABC now in Australia. Five commission in a row look at this cluster, cancer cluster, with finding no chemicals, no parental relationship between those women, and again pointing out at a potential cancer. So this is why we decided to look at that today. This is probably the most known, in fact, around the world, example of cancer clusters, which is not explained. A few other things that was talked in this, you saw a virologist mentioning that one-fifth of all cancer, I think, or half of all cancer were caused by viruses. We'll see this tonight, Dr. Brenton, and you will mention that too. But he also went so far to say that as much as 95%. So that's a very scary number. I think most of us will not believe that as much, but again, this is a discussion we will have. One other thing the lady in the trailer was saying is that it's not a concern, but in fact a cause for hope to have viruses causing cancer. And again, the idea of having vaccine, this is why she's referring to this. Maybe if that was the case, then maybe vaccine could be extremely interesting to eventually cure or at least prevent cancer. So this is the introductions for tonight. I'd like to give you other example of these cluster. I'll go back to my PowerPoint and and give you a few other examples that brings viruses. This is the Australian story. So there are cancer clusters all the time. People phone, even one of my dear friend was saying that in Hampstead there is a cluster of cancer in my street, you know. So I think there's many things, but in fact this is exactly happened in Eugene, Oregon. There was a very big cluster of cancer, and after a lot of studies, in fact it was a chemical in the environment that caused this. We'll go back on these things. But viruses have been known, the Nobel Prize of last year, Harald Zurhausen, that we both have known, Phil and I, through our work on papillomaviruses. He won the Nobel Prize for HPV work, but he still recently have found another virus which could cause other type of cancer and multiple sclerosis. So again, there's still in the literature, there's still quite a lot of work done on viruses and cancer. I'll give you another example, less a bit dramatic, but one that you would maybe like. Dolly the sheep. Probably you don't know Dolly, or everybody knows Dolly the sheep. And you know that it was named, everybody knows, or anybody knows how she was called Dolly. You know the actress Dolly Parton? She was very famous for part of her interesting attributes, I would think. I'm not sure. I shouldn't say interesting. Sorry, no comments on that. But already I'm in trouble. I know I was in trouble. But however, Dolly was cloned from mammary gland cells of a previous sheep. And this is why they call it Dolly. Okay, but that's not why I'm mentioning that here. Dolly, after you know all of these issues of cloning and dangerous genes that happens and cause diseases, finally died at an older age, and that's what you see here. She's in fact into she's how do you say this when she's stuff is you say that in English stuff? It's not very beautiful. Thank you. But in fact, Dolly died of a cancer, a lung cancer, caused by a virus called the Jaksiki virus, very well-known virus in sheep farming. So there are, in the animal world, tons of viruses that cause cancer. So it's the idea that this exists in human is not far-fetched at all, and there's plenty of example, and we'll see that. I don't want to pass all the evening, but I want to go back to a few little things in cancer, and I need to tell you, and that will bring our next speaker. So this is a cancer cells, but remember that we've talked about that in several sessions last year. Cancer is all about genetic changes. So you can have you cannot have a cells that become cancerous if there's no genetic changes. The DNA must be changed in a way that it produces more proliferations, more aggressive migrations, cells which will never die. So there's many changes occurs, and all these changes have to come one after the others. Just to show you an example of this, these modifications and changes can occur when cells divide. When you have a little cell of a baby and we grow up as a young and slim man like me, then in those cases, for sure, all the number of cells at the divisions, you could have mutation every time a cell divides. You can see that the entire there's billions, literally billions of DNA that has to be copied. A bit like you were taking a full town and try to duplicate this town from scratch, the chance that you make it exactly the same is extremely unlikely. Same thing here. So cells in our body, normal cells, have many mechanisms to repair. And we can repair. In fact, we can go in front of a TV with emit radiations. We can do quite a lot of chemical repair, you know, if we are ingesting chemicals. And that happens on a daily basis. However, when these repairs, there's more damage than the repair can be made, then these mutations start to occur and remain. The chance that it touches an oncogene, a gene that will give you cancer, is still remote because there's billions of nucleotides. So it's still the chance of having cancer is slim, but it's there. The reason why I'm showing that is that, however, there are many cases where these trigger of mutations can occur. T, welcome. Thank you very much for coming. Absolutely. I think that would be... So would she like to talk after me, T? Or after Phil? Would be better after Phil, if it's okay. It's in about 30 minutes. Maximum. So, Dr. T. Wong, I'm delighted that she's here, and I thank her very much for being here. So, you missed my scary movie, but don't worry, I'll send it to you. So, going back to the triggers of these genetic mutations, it can be done by chemical carcinogen, radiation, aridity, and you can imagine that each of those could be cluster cancer too. Let's say, you know, you have a family and you have a particular gene that is passed from the parents to the children. It's possible that you see in a family multiple cancer, and it's happened all the time. So this is not a cluster cancer in the sense that something weird happened. It's predictable by the genetic of the parents and the children. I mentioned to you that's my son. It has nothing to do, hopefully, with carcinogen. But I also mentioned to you chemical carcinogen, and the Oregon story is exactly like this. If you live in a particular region where there's a lot of chemicals, indeed, you will have a rise in these cancers. But normally, these cancers are very different. They will not be one particular cancer. And, of course, radiation is one of them. But what we're going to talk to you tonight is the next one, which is viruses. So viruses are, and some viruses, not all, are extremely good triggers of mutations, and they will lead normal cells to become abnormal cells and start the process of become a fully cancer cells and also, in some cases, very aggressive cells. I'm almost finished. This is an example of that where, in fact, a melanoma here, just a little mole which is not aggressive. Normal cells around, and you can start seeing also the cells which are in the process of becoming really malignant, changing color, changing shape. This we can see very just by looking at some of them. This is an example of a cancer you can see very much on the skin. And eventually, as I talked about, these cells will gain other mutations, and you end up with things like spreading and metastasis through the blood vessels, and that's what we talk about, secondary site and development of metastatic cancers. So I will stop there. See, this lady is thinking. And bring, in fact, Dr. Brenton to start talking to you about example of cancer and viruses. So we'll have all the questions at the end. Maybe before, no, that's not true. I promised Dr. Wong that after she talks, we may have the question immediately, so you can keep that in mind. So Phil, if you want to come and join us, we'll go to our second speaker. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'll put you up. Is this one, huh? Public, this one, yeah.
Michel mentioned he did his PhD with me. And it's surprising how well he's turned out, actually, after. I'm going to talk to you about infection, not just viruses, but infection and cancer. And my talk's going to be pretty conservative. The kind of numbers that were mentioned in the film are quite possible. I think in many diseases, including cancer, we've just scratched the surface on understanding the role of infectious agents, especially viruses, in those diseases. I believe a lot of the neurological diseases and so on probably have viral components. So the numbers I'm going to give you are conservative numbers. I'm almost positive they're going to be considerably higher. And even the number of agents I talk about are only the ones that are clearly confirmed. There are probably a whole bunch of other viruses, especially, that may be involved. So the question is, can you catch cancer? Well, sort of. About 15% of cancers worldwide, and a quarter of the cancers in developing world are caused by infectious agents in one way or another. They play a role. The number is lower in the developed world for reasons that you'll see as we go along. But nonetheless, that is I think that's a striking number, and I think the number will, as the years go by and research continues, the numbers will go up. In many cases, for the infectious agents, either sex or drugs are involved in one way or another in the passage of the disease. Very few of them are passed just casually. So sex and drugs can be a problem. As far as I know, rock and roll is still okay, although some may disagree, but I like it, and I hope it's safe. So here's a list of cancers. You don't need to read all of them over, but you'll see down on one side there's a series of carcinomas that clearly have infectious agents involved with them. There are three major lymphomas that have a serious, in this case, viral component to the disease, and a sarcoma. And these are all require infectious agents to play a significant role in their development. And there's eight or nine viruses I'll talk about briefly, but there's also a bacterium, and there are some parasite worms or flukes that are involved in some cases. And in many cases, these cancers, this is a worldwide phenomenon. Some of them are evenly spread, but in many cases there are pockets where the incidence of cancer resulting from these agents is much higher, and I'll mention that as I go along. Just to give you an idea, if you were infected by a virus, let's say, that plays, it's known to play a role in cancer, what are your chances? Well, here are the numbers for a cat virus. Any of you who own cats know that feline leukemia is a serious problem, and it's caused by a virus we know quite a bit about. And, in fact, there's a vaccine available for it. And I had a cat die from feline leukemia. Most people with cats now have them immunized. Vets recommend an immunization. So if cats are infected who haven't been immunized, about 2% of them become carriers. So that's a fairly low number. But of that 2%, a quarter or so, almost a third, get leukemia and die of feline leukemia. So clearly, we know quite a bit about how this goes. And so, this means that if you're infected, it doesn't necessarily mean that cancer will result. But there's a significant chance, and the risk of these people, in these cases, they're cats, is a lot higher than the normal population. As Michel nicely said in his introduction, these agents work in two major ways. Some of them have specific mechanisms to stimulate the growth of cells, and that we know about some of them, and others we don't. But they have genes that make products that when they infect the cell, they become latent and they stimulate cells to divide. Others do it more indirectly, probably by causing chronic inflammation or tissue damage, such as in the liver, as I'll talk about with liver cancer. And in these cases, this constant regeneration of cells increases the chance to have an event. But it means the virus probably plays a role somewhere down here before these other mutations accrue. And the role of these agents is probably to keep the cells dividing, so there's a greater and greater chance of getting mutations. And that's probably the way all of these agents work. Now, I'll quickly talk about a few of them. Epstein-Barr virus. It's a herpes virus in the same family as the virus that causes cold sores. It's linked to three major cancers, nasal pharyngeal carcinoma, and two lymphomas, Burkitt's and Hodgkin's. These are worldwide. However, there are serious pockets of these disease, and one of them is in Africa, in the so-called malaria belt. And the thought is that individuals get infected by this virus, and then if they have either are in poor health or their immune system is challenged, such as by having malaria, they run a much greater risk of having the cells proliferate and acquire other mutations. And this virus infects B cells in the bloodstream. These cells grow to high amounts, and they acquire downstream mutations. Now, this happens in Africa. Most of you know about EBV. It causes infectious mononucleosis, or the kissing disease. I got it just a few months after I started kissing, actually. And this is quite typical. Adolescents and late teens get this disease. And in most cases, that they don't feel very well for a while, but it goes away. It's self-limiting. And the reason is, here's an example. The time you're infected is a significant difference. In East Africa, in the malaria belt, you can see at a very early age, individuals seroconvert. That means they've been infected, successfully infected. And they are carrying the virus for a long period of time. On the bottom graph, U.S. high, that would be a high economic, people in a high economic bracket, they don't get infected until a much later age, in the teens. And they tend to get infectious mononucleosis, and very few develop these lymphomas. However, it's interesting, if you look at low socioeconomic populations in the U.S., they're intermediate. They are approaching what happens in Africa. So this suggests that general poor health, poor diet, and so on probably plays a significant role. That's what Burkitt's. It's an awful disease, and often in young children. And we actually know what the most important downstream event is in this disease. So here you've got a huge population of proliferating B cells, and then Burkitt's patients all acquire one of two classic mutations. And in this case, it's not a typical mutation. It's an exchange in the ends of these two chromosomes. Can you see on the right, the red one has a blue end, and the blue one has a red end? That's because pieces are broken off and exchanged. This is called a translocation. This exchange leads to a very specific activation of an oncogene that induces oncogenesis, and we know a lot about that one. I won't go into more details now. Then the other two, nasopharyngeal carcinoma, is usually found in Asia and parts of Africa, It may have a genetic component because it's common in China, in people of Chinese origin, and there may be a dietary component or an environmental component. And Asian and North American diets are quite different. So, and then the other one, Hodgkin's lymphoma, both young and old get it. The virus probably plays the same kind of role, but we don't know as well what the downstream events are. Now, you probably have heard of hepatitis virus. It's something you worry about when you go on trips to the Caribbean or South America. But the one you mostly know about is hepatitis A. That's the one you get by drinking water and eating bad ice cubes and so on. This causes a liver kind of hepatitis, but it's self-limiting. It's not... patients with infected with hepatitis A don't get cancer. But hepatitis C and hepatitis B are different. And here is hepatitis C. It's a small RNA flavivirus, and because of the type of virus it is, it's very hard to make a vaccine against HCV. But it causes... it's common in Africa and Asia. It's passed in blood, so it's high in drug addicts and transfusion people needing blood transfusions. That's how it's passed. And it again is a chronic infection of the liver, leading eventually to the outgrowth and production of a tumor. The other one, hepatitis B, is a different virus completely. It's a DNA virus. It is passed. It's usually sexually transmitted, or it's passed from mother to neonate to child, and it's predominant in Asia, Africa, and South America. There is a vaccine available. Many people get the hepatitis virus. It is against hepatitis A and B, this one. But there is no vaccine for hepatitis C. The natural history is very similar. There's an infection. Most people recover. Some of them become chronically or persistently infected. They develop chronic hepatitis, cirrhosis of the liver, and then many die either from liver disease or from the cancer induced by this process. Now, 5 years ago, Michelle mentioned one Nobel Prize last year for hepatitis virus. 5 years ago, there was a remarkable discovery, especially since I was a longtime ulcer sufferer. And this was the discovery that a bacterium played a significant role in causing stomach ulcers. This was an astounding result, frankly, and it's the kind of thing I think will happen over the years. More and more we will find diseases that we thought had nothing to do with infections, just might. And Barry Marshall and Robin Warren won the prize for showing that a bacterium, Helicobacter pylori, causes chronic gastritis and ulcers. And in fact, there is the little devil that in green crawling around the stomach lining. And it's a gram-negative bacteria. Half of us have been infected by it. It causes gastritis and ulcers. And this acute inflammation is believed to play a role, just like we've been describing, in causing repair, a constant repair of the gut. And that increases the odds of having tumors develop. Now, they can be cured. It can be treated with antibiotics. I had a duodenal ulcer for years. I'm now pylori free and ulcer free. And I think many of you may have been in a similar situation. It can be treated with antibiotics, but a vaccine might be better, because often you go 2 or 3 or 4 years before you quite realize what the problem is that you have. And so I think a vaccine would be a good thing. Two parasitic worms. They're ugly things. They're up in the right-hand corner. There's two of them there doing a waltz, I think. These are parasitic flukes that get into the your system through various means, water and so on. They're common in Africa, Asia, and parts of the Mediterranean. And again, they probably, just by chronic inflammation, enhance chances of getting liver, bile duct, and bladder cancer, because that's where they inhabit. Another virus, this is a virus that's in the same family as HIV, the AIDS virus. It's a retrovirus. It actually is the first human oncogenic virus that's been reported. However, it's really very localized. The human T-cell leukemia, this variation is high prevalence in Japan, but in other parts of the world as well, but much less common than in Japan. It's an adult T-cell leukemia. It's often sexually transmitted, and we have a good idea of how this type of virus can actually induce the mutations by inserting its genome in various places and enhancing the possibility of mutation. Human herpes virus 8 is also passed often by sexual transmission. It's often found in AIDS patients because it's passed along with the HIV virus. It causes a skin cancer that's very common in AIDS patients. And there are two other pretty rare diseases that this virus is linked to. This one, the treatment might, it's hard to make vaccines against herpes viruses. And so a vaccine, it's not clear how successful we'll be there. And the last one I'll talk about is human papillomavirus, and I only briefly mention it because my colleague is going to talk to you in detail. Up on the right is a venereal wart. I won't say whether it came from a man or a woman, this is the virus that is the major cause of cervical cancer. We know a lot about this virus. It's been extremely highly studied. There are two oncogenes in the virus, and we know how they induce, they can induce the early stages of oncogenesis. Cervical cancer in North America, women are typically screened. They get the pap smear, and the disease is picked up very early, and it's very treatable at an early stage. However, in India and parts of Asia, it's the major cause of women's cancer. It's more than breast cancer. The population is often highly infected, and they don't get early screens. There is a really good vaccine, as you probably all read in the newspapers in the last two or three years. A new vaccine has been developed, and there are questions that I presume will come following your talk, and I won't get into them now, but who should be vaccinated, how can we provide the vaccine, and so on. And I'll just finish with a story. Everything I've said about infectious agents sounds pretty awful. And if anything, the story will probably get worse. That is, there'll probably be more agents that we discover. But can they be of any value? And in fact, probably. This is a picture from the poster of the film I Am Legend. And I don't know if any of you saw it, but this is a film in which a company developed a virus to treat people with cancer, and instead it turned them into monsters. And Will Smith is a virologist running around trying to find a virus that can reverse all of this. Can we make viruses to treat cancer? Well, the idea, actually we can, and they exist. I don't know how many monsters have been developed recently, but there's two ways we can use these. Viruses are really good for immunizing people as a vaccine. This is the last. Oh, I thought you were going to throw me off. The viruses are very good for vaccines. So you could vaccinate against cancer or tumor antigens, and there's a lot of work being done in that area. But the other really more interesting idea is the so-called oncolytic virus, a virus that infects and kills only cancer cells, leaving normal cells untouched. And actually, a whole series. You can't read all that, but there are nine different viruses there under various phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials. So there's a whole bunch of interest and efforts, including serious efforts in Canada to actually develop oncolytic viruses to selectively kill off tumors. And I think that I'll stop there. I think this is an area that we've underestimated, including those of us who do research in cancer. We've underestimated, and if anything, I think the frequency of involvement of infectious agents in cancer is going to increase. And I'll stop there, and we'll do questions at the end, shall we?
Absolutely, for us.
Okay.
Thank you very much, sir.
So since Dr. Wong is also very busy, and we will take her little talk, and I think you have time for a few questions after.
Yep.
So I think that'll be good.
You better ask her your clinical questions. We won't be able to help. Well, we could try, but I don't think it would be probably dangerous to listen to this.
And we will go back to HPV, vaccine and food. I think may touch that too on her clinic, so that's important. Je sens pas ici. Merci beaucoup.
Good evening. It's my pleasure to be here with you tonight. I'm a radiation oncologist working in Montreal at the Jewish. And the objective for my talk to you today is what we see in our clinic in Montreal. So it's close by you. So it's directly not in Asia or in Africa, but directly in our communities. So there is my field of interest is GI. And as you know, unfortunately, it's very common nowadays in well-developed, if we can say so, country. And in the low GI, I have been always fascinated by a disease which is called anocanal, and it's very different than the common colorectal cancer, which is mainly adenocarcinoma. And anocanal is squamous cell cancer. What is very particular about this disease is that it's a disease which is by histology. It's a skin type of histology, but also is a disease which is extremely curable with radiation and chemotherapy. And since 1970, where before we know how to use well the chemo and radiation, patients that got this disease will have a major surgery with a permanent colostomy. So since 1970, we are now giving them chemo radiation, and in 85% of our patients, they are cured without any major surgery. Nevertheless, the strange thing is how come they are so sensitive to our treatment. So one of the things before, it was like many things, is a bit mysterious. And more recently, what we have realized, and this is in the same length of thinking of the two talks you have heard so far, is that there is a component which is virus. So it's very similar clinically and histologically with cervical carcinoma. Nevertheless, lately, you will see that there is a genotype which is more dominant, which is the HPV-16. And not only histologically, but virus-wise, they are similar. Anatomically, they're very close by one form the others, and they have the same type of behavior from very early change and progressing slowly over years to become an invasive cancer. And the thing which is a bit worrisome is that is a rising incidence of this type of cancer, which used to be very uncommon in our communities. And the interesting part of this disease is that there is a potential prevention with vaccine. So this is data which is really coming from Quebec, so our province. And you can see here that if you look in terms of evolution, it's not a very common disease. Nevertheless, which is a bit worrisome, is that we see that nowadays there is a trend definitively for a higher incidence of what used to be a rare disease. And you see it's a bit more common in women than in men, but it's present in both sex. And if the other thing which is a bit striking also is that if you look, because the virus, when you get colonized by the virus, you don't get a cancer first. You get what we call a condyloma. And what you see here is if you look at the incidence of condyloma, of course, there is a higher incidence in the community of Montreal as compared to the rest of the province. And if you look at the relative risk, it's in the region of Montreal, you can see that the risk seems to be higher over time. So from 1984 to 86, your incidence by living in Montreal is about 0.19 for a man, 0.38 for a woman. But as time go by, the last 1999 to 2001, it's now higher to 0.96. So there is definitively a rising incidence of this uncommon disease. So what is condyloma? As you can see, people think, usually patients think they have a hemorrhoid, okay? And they will go on years and years with this, thinking this is a hemorrhoid. In fact, it's not. It's a virus infection. And what we see, when I see them, usually it's no further a virus infection or hemorrhoid. It's become a big cancer. And what we have done before, we just treat them without really understanding why they got this. And this is a result that we did on our patient in Montreal. And to our big surprise, that it's really the virus is detected in 92% of our patients. So it's really directly related to the virus, and you can see here the different type of HPV virus that we can find in this type of cancer. And you can see that some has one virus and some patient has multiple virus that are involved, all of them in the HPV group. And finally, and this is something very less known to the medical community as much as in the general communities, is that I used to treat it for last 15 years, head and neck tumor. And one thing which is very fascinating is that most of the time we believe that head and neck tumor come from your smoking and drinking habits, which is still true. Nevertheless, there is a subpopulation that we never understood why they got this head and neck tumor. Usually it's in the throat. And they are people who never smoke or drink a very moderate amount of alcohol. And usually they're much younger than the population we expect to see in the head and neck patient who got cancer. And until lately, and this is a very nice light coming from the Denmark, and you can see here, as people understand now the toxic effect of cigarettes, people tend to try to decrease the cigarette smoking. Nevertheless, in the with time by, there is a rising incidence of oral pharynx cancer. So in order to understand what was happening is that when the testing has been done, and you can see, and this is really a fascinating finding, is that those patients who got what we call oropharynx cancer, who are non-smoker and non-drinker, and who are very sensitive to radiation and chemotherapy, so curable with radiation and chemotherapy, a patient who got the virus, unlike the patient who are smoker and drinker. So virus is more common than we think, and you heard that I'm sure that with time, maybe we will discover that other cancers are also virus-related. And the good news is that we can potentially prevent it with the introduction of vaccination in the community initially for GYN cancer, but it can also indirectly prevent the other cancer that we are seeing now. So that was my talk for you tonight. This is the Montreal reality. So.
Asking, and they're still thinking about it. You mentioned many patients which have many HPV viruses, and so the vaccine that we have from now, would they cover all of those, or are they are on one particular strain? I know we'll discuss that maybe after. But what do you feel about this? On the giving a vaccine for children.
I'm not sure if, because I think that the vaccine was introduced mainly for GYN cancer. And I think that since there is a very close similarity with anal canal cancer, we hope that potentially it could also prevent secondary cancer, which come from the same virus. Now, there is no test that has been done directly on patients with anal canal, because I think it's a bit more recently that we realize that this is related both for anal canal or head and neck cancer that are related. I think this is the number one. And I think the second thing, perhaps I will say that in order to have a prevention, and this is a personal message, likely that presently the provincial government only consider vaccinating a young girl. And as you can see, the two diseases I just present to you are affecting both men and women. So likely, eventually, if we really want this to be more beneficial, has to be also extended to a young boy.
We have a question here.
So I'm not sure how a person gets the virus in the first place.
Usually it's sexually transmitted.
Oh, okay.
So in this case, it's always, in this case, sexually transmitted disease. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, so there's plenty of questions there. So we're not going to keep you all evening, T, but we'll give you a chance to have a few questions.
If I stand.
Oh, yeah, you have a good voice. That's great.
Yes. Yes. Usually it's sexually transmitted. Doesn't mean necessary that you have to have anal sex, because this is the first question that my patient asked me. They said they never have any anal sex, so I believe that it's true. But it's true that I think that majority, surprisingly enough, is more in women than in men, like anal canal. And most of them are elderly women, it's not young women. So you need to have an incubation period before you get to that. There is no test presently for anal canal like for cervix, because it's not as common as cervix. But there is a patient at risk in the communities, and this patient normally screened. And I'm not sure about the name of the test, but it's equivalent to a pap test, but I call it the Q-tip test, that is done on a patient at high risk. And you can do a cytology type of things to see if you have early change, like for cervix cancer.
I think the HPV vaccine is usually given only until age 27, I think. Would it be beneficial for adult women too?
I don't think that older studies were done mainly in children and adolescents, but in adults, I'm not aware of any study that has been shown to be beneficial.
Thank you. Yeah. Any other questions?
Larynx, you said that the HPV virus is also in the larynx and oropharynx. How is that transmitted?
Usually it's also sexually transmitted.
Okay, I think we certainly had a good, interesting discussion to have later, and I'm sure later in the evening for some of us. But, T, thank you very, very much.
Okay, thank you.
I think certainly the point is made that viruses are important in cancer. That's what we wanted. Good night. And again, thank you again to be here tonight. Thank you. So we'll touch a bit more about HPV. And the person who's going to come to us at our talk, he's a specialist of epidemiology of HPV. And he will tell us a bit more about this. And we'll be able to, after that, have the questions and going on. So I'm trying to stay away from Amy. So Agni, I suppose. Do you have a short name, by the way?
I will declare my name.
Okay. Use this. I think this one.
Thank you very much for the organizing committee, as well as Michelle, because I keep on trying to attempt to spell my name correctly. I just say, of course, he is very nearly correct. In my circle, I'm known as Raman, so you can call me Raman. That's okay. So, in next few minutes, we're going to discuss about HPV and very specific to cervical cancer. This is a very favorite bug to our division because most of our salaries pay out of research on HPV and cervical cancer. Yeah. We all know, and some of my senior colleagues already mentioned here, that cervical cancer is mainly a disease that is concerned in developing world. Of course, we have just nearly one patient usually diagnosed out of 1,000 women with cervical cancer in Canada. However, most of this credit goes to the structural screening programs we have here, very organized screening programs here since 60s and 70s. However, we should remember that we have a clinical burden of precancerous lesions because you go to the cervix, but the results are not known. It is equivocal. Still, you have to go for repeated paps. So the clinical burden that we deal here is with the precancerous lesions. And also when somebody died in the middle age, like, you know, most of the women, they die in kind of 30s and 40s, which is a crisis to entire family. That is a very big concern for us. And also, in the early presentation, Dr. Tromley mentioned that during the movie, he mentioned 95% of cervical cancers may be attributable to HPV infection. Is that true? Look at these risk ratios. When we call risk ratio, that means you compare two set of people, one with those with HPV exposure, and the other set never exposed to the HPV. You look at the disease profile, both of them. In early 80s, you can see that there are about 5 to 6% of them, you can say that those who are exposed may have a risk of 5 to 7 times higher than those who never exposed. But over the period of time, by the time we get to the early 2003 or 2003 early decades, the numbers changed. Now we are talking about nearly, they have 1,000 times higher. That means if you take all the cervical cancer patients and you test for HPV exposure, you will find HPV infection in almost all these cells, which clearly attributes that it is a very necessary cause of this particular cancer. And we all know that HPV is a very common in the population. And the statistics what we have, the Health Canada statistics clearly mentions that 80% of the women develop HPV infection at some point of time in their life before they get to the 50 years. And we have an evidence here in Montreal by studying McGill and Concordia University students. They're kind of young adults. That we have about 55% of the women diagnosed with HPV infection. So it's a very common thing. There is nothing to stigmatize. There is nothing to really take it into granted. It's a very common sexually transmitted disease. And the risk factors, one of the important risk factors, as mentioned by the earlier speaker, is the sexual activity, the behavior, sexual behavior, whether you have a multiple sex partners or early age of sexual initiation or being young itself, because that is the age where you are more exposed to the. And there is a weak evidence from other studies that confirms the other groups, like, you know, inconsistent condom use and other immunosuppressed people or immune-compromised people are at risk. This is a prevalence rate. When I call prevalence, you go to a population, you look, you know, test the HPV DNA, test for the HPV DNA. And about 30% of them, you can see that in the age group, the peak gets like early 20s. The women in their 20 to 24 years, you will find about 30% of them do live with HPV. And also, we also talked about vaccine. Quite a few of you have several doubts about the vaccines. You can see the distribution of the types. If you look at entire HPVs, there are hundreds of HPV types. But the most dominating one is HPV 16, which causes the cancer. There are many other low-risk HPVs. Whenever I say low-risk HPV, they are just genital warts or just warts. But these are high-risk. The type 16, type 18, these are the two single most dominant HPV types that constitute about 70% of the entire distribution. So if we could eliminate, or if you could stop, prevent contamination with those two viruses, probably we can save people from, you know, progressing towards cervical cancer. That is the basic idea of HPV vaccination, targeting these two types. Coming back to our population, why only girls? Okay, we are going to talk about that in detail. But this figure shows that this is the sexual behavior of our little girls, those who are in, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18. This is the data taken from Sex Facts of Canada as well as North America. We have slightly higher rates than what you see, 1 or 2 points higher than this. What it means, most of our girls, one-fourth of our girls already had the vaginal sex by the time they get to 15 years. And by the time they get to the 19 years, 77% of the girls and few of the boys do have. So if at all vaccination is going to be in place, it should be done much prior to the first sexual act, before they expose to the HPV. Then only they will be protected. That's the reason we have chosen age groups like 11 to 13 years, much before 15 years or 14 years, so that they will be protected for HPV infection. The second risk factor we were talking about is multiple sex partners. This data clearly gives us an idea that these are the reported number of sexual partners in their lifetime in those women who were in 20 to 24 years. We can clearly see here that about 70% of them, reported they have more than two partners, and about 30% of them, they mentioned that they have more than seven partners. So what can save us? Probably condoms. Let us see. We have evidence that most of the studies are in McGill, the McGill cohort, and most of the studies are based on Canadian populations I'm talking about. This is the Hitch cohort, which is a huge cohort that looks at heterosexual transmission between men and women. About the condoms, you see that if somebody involved in 100 acts and they use a condom for about 5% of the time. That means 5 times out of 100. Then there is no protection from, you still have 100% of risk of getting HPV infection. Okay, let us try for half of the time. They tried half of the time condoms and half of the time they didn't try that. Still, you are at the same risk, 100% of the risk. What if they use 100% of them all the time whenever they're involved in the sexual activity? Yes, you have a 50% of the protection, but you still have 50% of the risk. So what are the other alternatives? At this point, one of our PhD researchers, he's Joy Turta, he was working on tropical microbicide gels. These are the extracted carrageenan stuff that has been extracted from seaweeds. So we have to wait at least a couple of years before I answer that question, whether it is effective or not. However, this is also very important to see how often, how fast we acquire the infection. This is the slide. These are the two slides you should know. The first slide on the top shows that how fast you acquire the infection. So we followed 630 women for about 5 years. These are the young women recruited from McGill as well as Concordia universities. And we try to see all those HPV negative women tested at the enrollment. We try to follow them. We keep testing for the HPV DNA every 6 months. And then you can realize from this data that about 60% of them developed HPV within 3+ years, but within 4 years, between 3 and 4 years. Are we really have to worry about it? No, we need not. Because HPV clears on its own. Even we need not know that we have HPV. We are infected to the HPV. So what happens? Look at the clearance rates. So about 75% of the infections been cleared within a year. And almost like 85 to 90% of the infection cleared within 2 years. We are really concerned about those persistent infections, those rejected to go out of our body. They're still there, persistent, they keep on, we test, whenever we test it, the HPV is still there. So we are concerned about those persistent infections because eventually they're the important things to draw our attention. So here is the natural history. What happens, what is the real relation between HPV and the cervical cancer? You see here, you are exposed to HPV, then there are episodes like it will make clear or it may progress or, it may persist for a long time. And then you may develop a disease which is called precancerous lesion. This is just a stage before the real cancer. So between these lines, before you get to the precancerous lesion and before it should be treated or it should be diagnosed from the smear, means pap test. Otherwise, that can go and develop as a cancer. So the trick is how to identify a precancerous lesion as early as possible. So we know that we have a conventional pap test in place for years. So this is a general, this is North American altogether, both Canadian as well as the U.S. Consensus form. So you can see that half of the cancers never, whatever we have, 50% of them never diagnosed or rarely screened in a regular routine screening programs. And about 10% of them mismanaged, and about 10 to 15% of them lost to follow-up. Oh, the woman probably because of her behavior, she neglects to attend the follow-up clinic or whatever it is. So this is a sort of secondary prevention. And you can see that conventional PAPs are very easy. Even general physician can do that. And it costs in Montreal about $25, roughly $25 to have a conventional PAP test. There are other sorts of screening tests like liquid PAPs, but we won't talk about all of them because we don't have enough time. One of the problems with conventional PAPS test is the sensitivity. When I call sensitivity, that means that if there are 100 women diagnosed with some sort of lesions, but 50 of them could go undiagnosed. That means you may miss half of them because the sensitivity is only 51%. Because it is very subjective. Because when a GP or a gynecologist take the smear, a technician will read the smear under microscope. It depends on what type of technician. It's a subjective. What time of the day he was reading that, and many other things. The quality of the smear, how they papped it, how they sampled it, and so on. So there is a new test that comes up recently, which is called HPV DNA test. Instead of a conventional pap test, people can send the smears to microbiology labs, and you can find it out. One of our other studies called CCAST, it is cervical cancer screening trial, it has come out with results like, this is very sensitive. That means with the help of a pap test, with the help of a HPV DNA test, you could be able to catch almost 100% of the diseases. That means the sensitivity is very high. And also you can see from here, this is the new algorithm. We have, the conventional algorithm says that you go for a cytology first, you go for regular pap, and then you refer to the other colposcopy or, depending on the results. But at this point, the world was advised, because this is not at the policy level. Still, people are working on randomized controlled trials and different other studies. The suggestion here is you go for HPV test before, you go for a cytology, and then that means you change the order. That is the suggestion. And depending on the results, the further follow-up will be there. So these are the new algorithms. We can discuss in details if somebody is interested. So apart from all these things, a very important thing is, there are a lot of other things involved, because there's a secondary screening. We have to screen them in between the trajectory. But however, what about vaccine? This is a primary prevention. That means you vaccinate a woman before sexual activity so that these vaccines are kind of virus-like particles. They mimicked the real virus of HPV. They send it to the boy, they give a shot. And then what happened? The body develops an antibody against these virus-like particles. So when the real infection enters into the body, it is ready to fight with the real infection. That is the whole mechanism behind the vaccines. And there is no, at this point, whatever existing research we have, they are pretty safe. And also, you can see there are two vaccines exist in the world, in the real world. One is a quadrivalent. It protects from four different types of HPV types. And the other is bivalent, only 16 and 18. The one called Gardasil from Merck Frost, and the other one is from GSK. It's called Cervarix. And you can see the target population. There was a question about target population. So the first one, probably you have to execute between 9 to 26 years, and the other one from 10 to 55 years. But the condition is that you should not expose to the HPV infection before. Once you are exposed, it may not protect, or it may not help to clear the existing infection. So there is no fun in giving HPV vaccine for those who are already infected. Whatever the age, you can give this infection when they were not exposed. The second one, the range is very high. That's between 10 to 15 years. So there are real obstacles at this point. We know that most of the disease burden is in developing world. A three-dose vaccine costs right now about $370 US. Of course, we are getting free on school-based programs in Quebec and other provinces in Canada. But what about developing countries? Can they afford that? Because universal immunization is already under question mark, because they have to give the regular immunization protocol to countries in Africa and India and many other countries. So can they afford this? Is it where we are? So that is one strong question. And also there is a strong lobby from the religious group. And also political groups. You know these democratic countries. Whenever somebody wants to give somebody, the opposition don't want to give that one. So there is always a consensus going against the vaccine. And also there is also professional rejection. That means they resist for the vaccine because they're used to a sort of clinical management and other ways of dealing with the cancer. They don't want this vaccine in between. So what happens to the screening? So once we have given this vaccine, can we stop screening program altogether, take rest? No. You still have to continue a screening program because of several reasons. Number one, the vaccine only protects from one or two important types. Still, you have a chance that you may expose to the other risk type or oncogenic types. So people has to follow the regular protocol. And, you know, it's a sort of transition which has to answer several questions at this point. And the argument, we have some positive arguments. The PAHO and WHO, they have a special program, a subsidized vaccination program for a developing world. So probably they can execute or, you know, distribute these vaccines at very subsidized prices for developing countries or those who are low-resource settings. So the second thing is, from our experience, we are sure that, you know, the cost will come down. This happens with other vaccines. So over the period of time, there will be several manufacturers, and because of the competition, you know, the production cost maybe, you know, goes down, or whatever reasons, the real cost probably come down. And that is also, there is a distinct possibility that the current regime of three doses, probably, you know, we may need just two doses. I know still there are many questions in our mind because, you know, we have to answer several other questions. At this point, the division, at our division, we are trying to address most of these questions through different randomized trials and different cohort studies and other things. So some of them are very important. For example, what is the duration of protection? We don't have a definite question because we started giving these vaccines 6 years before. So we need to wait for a long time to answer these kind of questions. And also, do we need a booster dose? Still, we have to wait to answer this question because we have to see what happens over a period of time. And can it save from other cancers or other HPV risks? We don't know really. Still, people are working on those things. And you can see whether is it effective from other types of cancers. We just talked about anal cancer. We just talked about esophageal cancers. Is it going to work on other specific cancers? Yes. There is a claim that it has a cross protection with a few of the rare cancers like oral, esophageal, and other head and neck cancers. But still, that has to be proved at a convincing level. And finally, this is a very important question that one of our PhD students is working on, that's the type replacement. Whenever you talk about, okay, you are ready to knock off two important viruses, HPV 16, HPV 18. It happens with the species, you know, all the species try to occupy the space. When we knocked off those two existing leading oncogenic viruses, probably other two types will want to take place, you know. That is how the species survive in this world. They want to occupy the same place. Then we may end up in another problem to find vaccines for other types of HPVs. So this is briefly all about what's going in the field of HPV and particularly in the context of cervical cancer. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much. So I do have, I will ask Phil and Hamatar to come and sit down, Ramana, to sit down in front to ask some question. But before that, I just want to give two slides very quickly. Just to take you the take-home message here. Okay, just pour finir la soirée. If it can't go there, that'd be good. Okay. So a few things to remember. So we've asked, is cancer contagious? So who thinks that it's contagious? Lift your hand. Okay, who thinks that it's not contagious? Well, I think we have half and half, but I think the conclusion that cancer itself is not contagious. You know, it's not. You're not gonna get cancer by hugging your sister or somebody in the family which has cancer. Cancer is not contagious. A healthy person cannot catch cancer from someone who has it. So don't hesitate to talk to your friend. But yes, germs are contagious, and we've seen this. We've seen many examples of viruses. So you can get the virus, or these many different viruses or bacteria, and these can increase your risk. Germs can affect your cancer risk. And we saw many. I'm not going to go back to that. But what I want to finish my last slide says, most cancers are not linked to germ of infection, as far as we know. Although tonight we saw many questions on the Australian broadcasting story where perhaps there are viruses that, in fact, in those women, which when they went back, all had HPV. Is HPV causing breast cancer? Probably not. It's present in everybody. Nobody has really shown that. Why there are cancer clusters we talked about, and I mentioned three things to remember. One is family members share the same genes, right? If you have the same mutation in the family, you may have the same genes coming up. Families may have similar unhealthy lifestyles, diet, smoking. I come from a family which is very typical of that. I'm not sure if it's genes or behavior, but my mom come from a family of 14 brothers and sisters. 10 of them are dead of cancer now. 5 of colon cancer, about 3 breast cancers. We have a good genotype or family bad habit in the family. But certainly, I'm losing weight, as you can see. Very quickly, so that would be...
I hope you're not following in my footsteps.
He seems not to support my contention here. And finally, may also family members, we're talking about cancer clusters in one family here, can be exposed to the same cancer-causing agent. So if you have chemicals around or neighborhoods around, definitively cancer cluster can come. Most important to finish the slide, people with cancer need to be around other people. So again, we know cancer is not contagious. Don't be afraid to visit a person with cancer. They need your visit and support. And so although this sometimes crosses the minds of some people, and it only makes people with cancer more lonely. So remember, it's not contagious. Go give a hug. So now we'll stop there. And if you have any questions, oh yeah, very important. I have some questions that people send me. Most important, you have also a questionnaire if you want to, evaluation of tonight of our speakers, particularly Dr. Brenton, my old boss. It's time to pay back. So don't hesitate to ask anything. And I keep the questions with me just in case we don't, and we have about 10 minutes maybe to ask questions. It's about the time, and I will go around. You have a first question.
I think you mentioned about the feline carriers and cats that carry the leukemia. And I think you said 2% are carriers. Would that infect children and adults in that household?
No. Most viruses, of course, there's been a few famous exceptions recently with flu virus, but most viruses don't cross species barriers. And so cat and dog viruses, we never get them. The cases like with SARS and with the Asian, the flu recently, are rare, but they do occur. But not with feline leukemia virus. It should be, Michelle mentioned about hugging. You should remember that in all the cases I know he likes to hug. In all the cases I talked about, when the cancer develops, the virus is not, or the agent is really no longer there. It's only needs to be there generally at the beginning of establishing the cancer. It's usually not maintained.
As a grandparent of a 14-year-old granddaughter, I'm very interested in the vaccine for HPV. Are the school boards buying into vaccinating the students or not?
So what's the question?
So the question was, the school board the board for promoting vaccine?
Yes.
Yeah,
at this point, the federal government and the provincial government are working closely with the different schools. and the vaccination program is only school-based vaccination program. The criteria they have is those girls who are in secondary, third, and fourth grades. And also the upper limit they have, irrespective of age, the upper limit they have is those who were born after 31st August 90, that is 1990. So they're closely working, you know, it's not just the program, it's a lot of, counseling, counseling parents, counseling teachers, and also, show the efficacy of the vaccine. You know, we have already a randomized trial based on, like, school programs, and we have a definite protection for the vaccine. So it's so always, all the communication was negotiated with
the school. So the question is, yes, the school board are involved in this, and it's good.
They are. They're part of the
Okay, program. Very good. I have a few questions that have people, and I'll go there, but at the same time, I'll ask questions. So where do you get HPV DNA test? Is that your physician? You go to your...
Who gives your physician, you can volunteer with your physician. It costs about $9,200 at this point. There are private laboratories, there are other laboratories, microbiology laboratories who can do this test for you. But you can volunteer at this point. But at this point, it's not part of the policy.
Okay. I have a question for both of you, which is an interesting one. So if a person had the mononucleosis, one of those kissing disease, is he or she more at risk for cancer?
The risk is 30 times if you're in Africa where have poor diet and poor conditions in North America. It's much lower if you're infected later in life. I don't know what the number is, but it's not a huge risk factor. It's mainly infected early in life with poor in relatively poor health.
I think this question is a little bit more related to your speech. Yeah, with germs are contagious. My husband is going to China next week for the first time. There are several schools of thought. You don't need any inoculations. You do need inoculations. Typhoid, hepatitis A, tetanus. What are your thoughts on any of those vaccines?
You can. There are a couple of sites. One is the Health Canada website. You can look at it. And the second one is look at the local travel warnings on Canadian Council websites. Website. So that will help a lot.
The Australian woman that got cancer in that cluster there you mentioned, do you know if these cancers were similar? In other words, were they estrogen positive or negative and they're aggressiveness, et cetera.
I cannot tell you that. I don't know. They all have breast cancer, but which one? It's a very interesting question. In fact, it would be useful to know if it was exactly the same virus or not. So that I don't know. But I know that
if it was a virus, I'm still not convinced, but. I mean, the unusual thing is, I told you the low probability of getting the disease if you're infected. So even if everyone in that environment had been infected, viruses don't usually trigger cancer in all the people. So that's why I think it's probably something else.
Early in the discussion, you talked about malaria being a primary disease to a secondary one. If one had malaria, would they build up antibodies to prevent possibility of secondary diseases if the malaria has been cured?
The problem with malaria is it really taxes your immune system. So it tends to make you more susceptible to other things, and EBV is one of those other things. That you're in pretty... not in very good health when you have malaria.
I have a funny question here, too. And now somebody really wants to torture me. So does increased stress resulting from meeting somebody in the family which has cancer will decrease your immune system and then raise your cancer risk? So, you know, somebody has a twisted mind here. But Dr. Brenton.
I've had a... Michelle mentioned I went through 8 years as head of the Institute of Cancer Research of Canada. That's the federal government. That's like the NCI in the U.S. at NIH. Stress is always something that's people think about. And all I can say is that if it's a factor, it's a pretty minor factor, really, really minor. Nothing compares to tobacco, nothing.
Okay.
Tobacco is over 10 times more dangerous than anything else you can think of, and in fact, probably a lot more than 10 times more.
Can I ask you about the one question here is about why did the division concentrated on HPV? Is there a reason? Is there more money going that way? Or is there a real reason? Or?
Oh, no.
Not that, you know.
Nothing
not that you know.
Specific.
Well, it's. I mean, it's. I said it's in the third world. It's the leading women's cancer. So it's a serious international health problem. There's also a lot of really good virologists who study that virus, as you know.
Yeah.
And I think people always believed that a vaccine was possible. And so that stimulates science. It also stimulates companies to invest to make a vaccine.
That's true. And also I can emphasize some other thing. Virus, like infection as a causal agent, has been ignored for a long time. Only in the last 20 years it has been emerged as a prominent area of research. So probably Eduardo, who is a leader of this team, is right there to catch this particular opportunity, and he did that.
Yeah, Dr. Franco, could not come tonight, but we're very delighted to have you.
Exactly.
Eduardo is very well known around the world for his work.
Exactly.
So just on that, before she asked the next question, you talked about women, and the question here is, are men transmitters of HPV? Can HPV be transmitted spontaneously?
Yeah.
Spontaneously?
That's spontaneously. Okay. I don't know. It's like...
I can answer that. Yes, we have evidence from Montreal. We have a study called heterosexual transmission. So we calculated a probability of transmission. Probability of transmission for two things. One, probability of transmission per single partner, and a probability transmission for a single coital act. So we have a definite statistics on that. It's 30 to 70%. That is the probability that HPV transmit from male to female. And vice versa, we don't have evidence.
Of course, still related to sexual operation.
Exactly.
I mean, there is the toilet seat theory, but that's probably not true.
Yeah, so we were talking about the vaccines for HPV, and let's say the Gardasil protects against four types of HPV. For someone who has been infected, I think I heard that the women shouldn't get the vaccine if they've already been infected with HPV.
Means it's not protective. It's not efficient. You know,
but still can get. Even if, let's say, they had type 16, and then there's three other types in the vaccine, so it wouldn't make any difference, basically. No.
Because it's clearly seen in other randomized controlled studies, over 8,000 people, that the vaccine may not clear the existing infection. Vaccine may not help to reduce or protect once it's already there in your body.
But the point you made is a really interesting one. Would you prevent infection by other serotypes? And what is the consequences of that? And we probably don't know the answer
at this point.
That.
We don't know.
On a une question ici. Avez-vous quelques autres commentaires sur concernant la prévention du cancer? C'est Phil, peut-être que tu peux répondre. Sur la prévention, cancer prevention, la prévention du cancer, quelle est ton opinion vis-à-vis ça?
Well, donc, on dit que... il y a les gens qui disent que la moitié, 50% de cancers, on peut prévenir. Il y a des... moyens de sont causés sont prévenables, c'est un mot. Les autres disent 50%. Peut-être c'est possible, mais il y a beaucoup de monde qui dit que c'est 90%, 90%.
Yeah.
I don't believe that. The if once si on enlève le tabac. Tobacco alone is probably 33%. So the rest, the chances of preventing other cancers with diet, exercise, that will help. But it's a really small effect relative to tobacco. That's my view. The numbers so far don't go against that. Unless things change. And I might say, Canada is starting, has started a major cohort. It's a Canadian cancer cohort across the country in all the provinces. Quebec is one of the leaders, Ontario and Alberta. We're inscribing 300,000 individuals that we will follow. With time, and we will learn out of this the real truth about the potential for prevention. Right now, we're basing our numbers and our beliefs on studies that are far too small, and you certainly know about epidemiology. The studies are too small. We need big numbers. We need big numbers. Big numbers. Because there's nothing like tobacco, that's why we need big numbers. Tobacco, you could probably have found, you know, looking at 50,000 people or less.
Are we more at risk of getting cancer if we don't have a very strong immune system or if our lymphocytes are low? Or does cancer cause us to be deficient in our immunity?
Well, I'm not an expert, but that's an interesting question. Actually, it used to be the question about viruses. Did the virus cause the cancer, or is the virus there because it grows better in cancer cells? This was the classic argument. This is a classic argument.
Okay.
And this is the same kind of argument. Probably, we have very powerful immunosurveillance. We're probably generating cancer or precancer cells relatively frequently, but they are virtually all eliminated by our immune system. Once our immune system is impacted upon, the chances of cells slipping through, obviously, I think, has to go up.
Thank
so
you very
I
much.
I think it's the former, not the...
We'll go just a bit fast because we have many questions.
Just to supplement the argument, we have certain cancers the frequency of cancer, certain type of cancers are more among immunosuppressed people, the people who are affected with kind of HIV or AIDS or something. There are certain cancers are more frequent among those populations, which indirectly you can you can relate to this.
Thank you. There's a question that it was in fact on your slide and we didn't ask yet, and I think it's very important. If males are carrier of HPV, how come they are not vaccinated? I think it's a very important question. Why is it our daughters only which got the vaccine? And in this case, it seems to me that they should be vaccinated too.
That's a very good question, frequently asked in different forums. First of all, you have to see the number of cancers, what type of the cancers the male will get. It's like a HPV-related cancers, the cancers that are specific to HPV. If you look at cervical cancer, we have enough evidence that, you say like 90 to 100% of the cervical cancers may be really attributable to HPV. If you take other cancers, male, that are related to HPV, they're very rare. Number one, penile cancer, anus, because we have seen they're just 0.5 out of 100,000, which means only one out of 2,000 male. So if you accumulate all these number of cancers, it's not cost effective at this point. There is no argument that why, there should not be any bias, gender bias in terms of HPV vaccination, but at this point, it's not cost effective. That's the reason male kept outside of the regime.
In the long run, this gets passed from males to females. In the long run, vaccinating everyone would probably reduce the frequency of infection significantly, a lot better than condoms.
I think out of two vaccines that I mentioned, only one of the vaccine, the Gardasil, is the only, the Gardasil was supported by the Quebec government system here. The other vaccine, which is completely voluntary, if somebody wanted to go for a vaccination, they had to pay for it, and that's up to their physician and their. They can get it because they advocated that period is 10 to 55 years. So, those who are within 55, they can try it.
There's a lot of talk about the effects of climate change, particularly increased temperatures and the spread of infectious diseases. How do you think that will affect the incidence of cancer, and can one do anything to prevent or lower the risks?
Who's taking that? Yeah.
That's a hard one to answer, but I can give you my answer about the environment, which is overall... with a couple of rare exceptions, cancer rates have not changed in the last 40 years. And I think the environment has changed a lot. So I think the change in environment is probably awful for our health, but it remains to be established that it has anything to do with cancer, increasing the risk of cancer. Cancer rates are not increasing if you correct for age. They're just not.
That's interesting. So we have a quick question. I'll pass quickly because we really want to get to those. And so I have a question here. A gentleman or a lady asked that his or her daughter has received two Gardasil injections 2 years ago. Should the person go for a third shot? And you mentioned about the booster. Is that recommended now? Not yet?
No. The complete regime is three shots. And we don't know at this point how... it was effective with only two shots, so we don't have
any. So far, no. Okay. Another thing, hormonal contraceptive. If you take contraceptive, of course, again, my daughter don't take any of that. Is they have higher risk factor risk with contraceptive? That's an interesting question.
Oh yes, oral contraceptive probably work as a cofactor, not as a risk factor straight away, but it helps to develop your outcome, whatever it is, whether it is HPV or cervical cancer. It works through other existing risk factors. Somebody who is taking oral contraceptive probably already at high-risk behavior. We don't know for what reason.
So it's more on the behavior. So if you have contraceptive, you have more partners, more chance
exactly.
to have.
So we treat it as a co-factor than the risk factor.
I'm making this too simple here. Sorry, I apologize. Okay, so again, I'm moving.
This is a great turnout.
I have more questions I can chew. So one is, again, a choice between these two vaccines. So that's important. I'm not sure if there's any company people here. You'll be chased afterwards. But is it better to get the quadrivalent vaccine or the other one?
if it is government side, like the both were approved by FDA, the both are legal, but at this point the provincial government support only one. The other one is up to a personal choice.
As research scientists, how do you study transient viral infections as etiological agents of cancer?
Transient infections. If you're really asking about hit and run, that's a complicated question, which I could answer, but I'm not sure that was what was the intention of the question.
Yeah.
Transient infections, most infections are fairly transient. It's very rare that that a latent infection gets established with most agents. Of course, there are exceptions. Was it your question? So you want to know how we study transient infections? With some of these agents, and I could name a few, the genome of the virus is still there, even though there's no virus per se. It's not producing tons of virus, but there's evidence of the virus there because its DNA or part of its DNA is there. With many of the other agents, that's not the case. So they're all transient. They come in, they induce some kind of proliferation or and so on, and then they're cleared and they're pretty much gone. But there are some. HPV is certainly one of the cases.
Probably I'll answer that not as a research scientist, but as an epidemiologist. Yeah, you can address some of these kind of, I mean, by study design itself. So you are more efficient to measure the transient infections in the cohort settings where you follow the women for over 5 years, 13 years. So you see every periodically, every 3 months or 6 months, what happened, the status.
Okay.
So that's how you relate.
Thank you. So we're almost there. I know all of you are, maybe some of you want to have a coffee.
There is a baseball game on tonight.
So I'm not closing here. Give me a few minutes. There's one here that I really like. I'm sorry for those which will not have all the time. You can maybe come and talk to the people. It's a long question. There's a few things, but we'll end on this. I think it's an important one. With regards to HPV, how long does it take for the precancerous lesion to become cervical cancer? Oh, we know that.
Between 2 to 24 years.
So that's helping.
2 to 24 years, that's pretty good.
No help for this. If a PAP and DNA tests are done regularly, do we need to take the vaccine? So if you go regularly to your physician.
Yeah, you can choose one of those, but it is more cost-effective to have vaccine than go for HPV test, which costs $100 every time.
I mean, we've done quite well with just the pap smear in the last 30 years. The cervical cancer,
that's
although there's a fair amount here, it doesn't compare with other parts of the world.
And there's still many people dying even with pap smear.
One of my best friends died of cervical cancer.
So two more things and finish. The same individual which asked those questions. Will there be any screening methods for HPV among men? Is there anything planned, you think, and any that will be screened?
Oh, there are a couple of studies ongoing right now.
Already? Okay, so that's good. And there's a last question for Phil. What's the range of time that hepatitis caused by virus to a tumor? How long it takes for hepatitis virus infection to lead to cancer, liver cancer?
I'm not really sure of the answer. It's some time, and in most cases, you're quite ill for years with chronic hepatitis and cirrhosis of the liver. So it's not weeks; it's years. I don't know if it's 10 years, but it's many, many, many months, I think.
So I think I have a few questions. It was more clinical. I took them off. We're not clinicians. We didn't want to go into a personal history of clinicians. So I apologize for those of you which have asked. I'd like to thank all of you for being here tonight. thank our volunteer, which came and helped us on the site. I am going to switch the slide very quickly. Rosalind Dale, Ivy Ella, Barbara, Sheila, Annette Novak. On our side, Sarita Benchimol, Petal Steele, Gillian Huard, and Abby, which has just joined our team at the Cancer Center. I'd like to again thank you all. Have a safe way home. And thank you.
They were good. There's a lot of people.